All right, let's go ahead with our second case then, United States versus Prado and Sands, and Mr. Stewart for the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Charles Stewart, and I represent the appellant Fernando Sands. Attorney Adam Tavides represents the co-appellant Thomas Prieto, and of course he's seated at council table. But I alone will be presenting the argument on our side of the case this morning. The appellants were indicted by a federal grand jury in Hammond on a charge of possession with intent to distribute methamphetamine. The defendants went to trial in June of 2007, were convicted. Subsequently, both defendants were sentenced to lengthy prison terms. Both appellants timely filed their appropriate notice of appeal to get this case to this court. In our briefs, both Sands and Prieto raise numerous issues, and without denigrating or waiving those issues, I want to address three issues this morning because of time constraints, and I think they're the most significant issues. The first issue is, did the trial court commit reversible error and in overruling the defendant's objections and denying the defendant's motions for a mistrial after the arresting officer testified on two occasions that after the defendants had been placed under arrest, both defendants remained silent? The second issue, which I will address, is did the district court commit reversible error when it overruled defendants' objections to the testimony of a DEA agent that he reviewed the jail phone calls of the defendant because he initially believed the defendants may have been involved in another unrelated drug investigation that he was working on. The third issue is, did the district court commit reversible error when it admitted to evidence over the defendant's objections co-conspirators' statements in these jail phone calls between Sands, Prieto, an individual who's identified, I think, only by Nuco, when the government did not establish that a conspiracy existed and did not establish that the defendants in Nuco were involved in the conspiracy. The standard of the appellate review on all of these issues, because it revolves around the admissibility of evidence by the district court, is a review under the abuse of discretion standard. First of all, in regard to the defendant's silence at the time of arrest, the defendants were arrested or stopped on a traffic stop. They were initially questioned or about a traffic stop. I believe it was they were speeding and they were going off the side of the road. Eventually, the defendants allegedly consented to having their vehicle searched. The vehicle was searched. Methamphetamine was discovered in the bumpers of the vehicle. The defendants were then placed under arrest. Now, at the trial, the arresting officer testified on two occasions that once the defendants, let me back up a little, before the defendants had been arrested, they were answering any question that the police officers were asking of them. After they had been arrested, placed in handcuffs, the defendants remained silent. Now, the government elicited from the arresting officer that immediately after arrest, the defense remained silent. Now, the district court initially, when we objected to this testimony, initially overruled the objections of the defendants and and did not really rule on a motion for mistrial, but stated, I don't see this as a silence issue.
What was the mistrial motion made at that point?
Correct. But the district court initially overruled the objection. We went on to other testimony, and later in the record, about 8 or 9 pages later in the record, the district court reversed itself, sustained the objections of the defendants to the silent, what I'll refer to as silence testimony, struck it from the record, and instructed the jury that the defendants had an absolute right to remain silent and that the jury should not consider the defendant's silence at the time of their arrest in any way in reaching the verdict in the case. And then the trial proceeded. As I indicated, before they were arrested, the defendants were talking, were responding verbally.
Sir, wasn't there actually a video of this?
So and there was also a video.
The jurors could see that.
There was also a video. Yes, that's true. There was also a video of that, but the video was highlighted by the government prosecutor by specifically referring the arresting officer that the defendants remained silent after they were arrested. Now, it is our position that the jury could have very reasonably inferred that prior to the defendants being arrested, they were cooperating with the police, they were answering questions, they certainly were not remaining silent or exercising but after they were arrested and after the drugs were discovered, all of a sudden they remained silent. The jury could infer, well, why aren't they stopped talking? Why did not respond and deny or say something that they didn't know the existence of?
Couldn't the jurors see that from the video?
Well, I'm not sure that is entirely clear because the video, if you remember, both defendants spoke Spanish principally almost entirely in the video. So I'm not sure that the jury could really pick up on that.
The officer was obviously speaking to them in Spanish.
Obviously he was at times, yes.
Well, I think that's how they were communicating, I think.
Correct.
And
correct.
Wasn't there some problem with the audio in the video?
I'm trying to recollect. Well, I think that there probably was because in most trials I have, there's always a problem with the audio or video and the equipment.
But it's also the officer was talking his way through this. Right, he was describing.
He was trying to describe the situation. Now, our argument on this issue is, and I believe the law is, that a prosecutor violates the defendant's Fifth Amendment rights either to remaining silent or not to testify by having the government directly comment on the defendant's silence. And here is absolutely clear that it was the intent of the government to bring out, I mean, this was not an inadvertent mistake, to bring out that the defense remained silent. Now, how can I say that? I can say that because it just wasn't one blurt out. There were two specific questions where the officer testified and the testimony solicited. Additionally, at the first bench conference when we made objections to this testimony, the prosecutor stated on the record that the defendant's silence was relevant evidence that should be presented to the jury. Now, the district court initially accepted that, but later reversed its field. Now, but if a prosecutor says silence is relevant evidence that can be presented to the jury, I don't think there can be any question that it was the intention of the government to direct the jury or to get in front of the jury that the defendants had exercised remained silence. Now, the case law is also is after the court on this issue looks at the comment on the defendants remain silent, that one incident, or in this case, this two incidents. Then they take a look at the entire record to see if there is a pattern of which will show that intention, but more than that, to show that the conviction was a result of a denial of due process. Now, what do we have in this case? The government called a DEA agent who testified, and it was elicited from him, that the he reviewed the tapes of the defendant's phone calls at the jail pending trial. And the reason he did that, because he initially thought the defendants might be involved in an unrelated drug investigation. Now, we objected to that as violation of 404B. Now, the government said, well, that is, you know, we have to set a foundation for the admission of the tapes. Well, the problem with that is all the government prosecutor would have had to do is to ask the DEA agent, during the course of your investigation in this case, did you have occasion to review the jail phone tapes of the defendant? Yes, and then play the tapes. There was no need to go into the fact that the DEA agent initially thought that the defendants were involved in a drug another unrelated drug case. But in this case, it's more onerous because the government found out and the agent found out they weren't involved in any investigation. There was no connection. So the government was putting forth false testimony, knew that was not true, and trying to make that inference to the jury.
Did the government refer to this silence in final argument?
I don't believe they did, but I'm not absolutely. I don't believe they did, because I'm sure if they did, we would have objected and moved for a mistrial again. I think once the judge gave reverse field, struck the testimony, and gave an instruction, that was not mentioned again.
That was a pretty thorough instruction, wasn't it, in striking that testimony?
Yeah, and quite frankly, it was drafted, I think, by the court, by myself, and by the government prosecutor. What I am saying here, and I want to reserve a few moments for a rebuttal, is in this case there's no question that the government intentionally set about to comment on the defendant's exercise of silence after they were arrested. They furthered that by injecting into the trial something they knew was not true, that the DEA agent or that the defendants were involved in another drug investigation by the DEA. The DEA agent had considered that and rejected. There was no point to that being submitted to the jury other than to prejudice the defendant. And we would request that the court reverse the defendant's convictions here and remand this case for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Ratcliffe.
Good morning, Judge Mannion, Judge Tinder.
Good morning.
My name is Assistant United States Attorney Tom Ratcliffe. I represent the government in this case, obviously. I am the trial lawyer. I would love a chance to respond and during some of my argument here to the allegations that have been made by defense counsel, both in their briefs and at oral argument. First of all, with respect to the silence issue, counsel repeatedly says that the government twice elicited testimony regarding the fact that the defendants, when they were taken out of that car on the side of the road, on video, at gunpoint, remained silent, did not say anything. The government did not elicit that testimony. As set forth in the brief, the government's brief at page 11, footnote 2, Commander Martinez, the arresting officer in this case, testified, in the course of a narrative, we put them back in my police car. They said nothing at all. That was his first reference to nothing being said at the time of the arrest. There was no objection of any kind at that point. It was only later on, as the video was being played, because we went through in a sort of just testimonial fashion what happened during this traffic stop. Then we put in the video, and the entire video of this traffic stop was played to the jury. Getting to one of the questions that was asked earlier, the video was played without audio because without audio after the officer shifted to speaking to the defendants in Spanish. After he asked for consent, defendant Sands sort of looked at the officer after the question for consent to search the car had been posed in English. Commander Martinez, who was fluent in Spanish, then shifted to Spanish. The rest of the audio then was in Spanish. At that point, the video was, the sound was turned off, and the video was played. So during the time that the video was being played without any audio was the second reference that Commander Martinez made. And he said, again, quoting from my footnote, and this is, again, as the Commander Martinez is commenting on the video, "And I tell Officer Musgrove to handcuff him, and neither Sands nor Prieto said anything." The government did not elicit that testimony. I recognize that at sidebar, when discussing this issue with Judge Simon, I told Judge Simon that, you know what, it is relevant that the defendants stood mute upon being arrested at gunpoint. What I was getting at there was an inartful way to say it. I was getting at an argument that I wanted to make in closing argument, and a point that I did make that did not go to their silence. It went instead to the expressions on these men's faces after they've been placed in this squad car, taken out after a search by several officers is going on the video of the car that the defendants were either driving or a passenger in. They're taken out, they're placed on the hood of the squad car in full view of the camera and arrested. And you can see when they're directed out of that squad car at gunpoint, you see them come up there, and as I said in closing argument, it's just another day at the office for them. They are totally nonplussed. They have no expression of surprise or anything that indicates that they didn't see this coming, that they didn't see this arrest coming. They're arrested at gunpoint, and they stand there just looking at the camera. In fact, as I said in closing argument, Defendant Sands, the driver of this car, while he's being handcuffed, while he's waiting for Mr. Prieto to be put in the squad car, standing there with his hands then cuffed behind his back, and he yawns on the side of the road. And we have still photos that were introduced, still screen captures that were introduced as evidence in this case.
Well, what's that supposed to imply? That they're either resigned to the fact, or it's routine, or what?
Well, Judge Mannion, what I argued was, because we know that this vehicle that Mr. Sands was driving was registered in his alias name, Nicholas Cardenas, and because we know, and this is not mentioned in the briefs, but it certainly came out at trial, that in the course of, I believe it was about 10 or 11 months, there were about 60,000 miles, if I recall correctly, put on this car. And we know the defendants were Mexican nationals and had a connection at least to somebody in Indianapolis from the phone calls they were making. Our point was, if you've got a car registered in your alias name, you've put a ton of miles on it in a short period of time, and it's got hidden compartments in the front and rear bumpers sufficient to hold 9 pounds of methamphetamine, this is just another day at the office for you. You know this day might be coming. You've prepared for getting caught. And you know what? It's not a big deal. And that's what I was getting at in saying, well, they stood mute. The point is that there were no questions being posed to them during the time that they were arrested. The government did not intend to elicit testimony regarding the fact that the defendants said nothing. But the testimony, of course, did come out. But the point is, because there were no questions being posed to them at the time, the jury was not being asked to draw an adverse inference from the fact that they stood there saying nothing during their arrest. I did ask them to draw that inference regarding the defendant's expressions and the defendant Sands yawning during this arrest at gunpoint. But because, in addition to that, because there was an extensive curative instruction given after the second objection and after then the court had time to consider it during a break, any possible error that was created in this case as a result of these statements was wiped away by the curative instruction.
After the first objection, why didn't you pull Martinez aside, woodshedding a little bit, and say, look, we're not going there?
I didn't feel like I had that opportunity, Judge Tinder. While he was on the stand in the middle of my direct examination, I didn't feel I had the opportunity to say to Judge Simon, could I have a moment with the witness?
When there's an objection that results in a motion for a mistrial, that's not of sufficient importance to you to,
well,
just for a break to talk to the witness to make sure he doesn't go back to that area?
Judge Tinder, this goes to the error that counsel made. During the first reference, Commander Martinez's first reference to this, there was no objection. It was only after his second reference when the video was playing.
And apparently there was a third?
No. There were only two references, Your Honor.
So there's no objection to the first, and then
Correct.
There's an objection to the second one.
Correct.
And that generated the instruction?
It did, Your Honor. Now, with respect to the issue about the alleged 404B evidence by DEA Special Agent Dave Ritchie, counsel again has suggested, not suggested, has clearly stated that in my that the government elicited false testimony. There was no false testimony in this case. Agent Ritchie testified that the reason he went to get these audio tapes from the Porter County Jail was because he was concerned about a, quote, possible connection between these defendants who were coming from the Lafayette area and another investigation that he had.
And so what? Why does it matter why he went to get them? That he got them at all is all you're concerned about in terms of evidence to the jury on these charges.
It is. I was simply trying to tell the story to indicate how, after the defendants were arrested, 2 weeks later, their phone calls from the Porter County Jail were even listened to or reviewed by anyone.
It sounds like you wanted him to tell why, not how. Not just how, but also why. And that why relates to some other investigation that admittedly doesn't involve these two defendants.
Well, the why in terms of why he went to get the videotapes certainly does not, certainly explains to the jury why we spent the manpower or the resources to go get jailhouse tapes and listen to them. But again, because Agent Ritchie only said that there was a possible connection, that was the reason he went to get the tapes, at the time he thought there was a possible connection to another investigation. He didn't even say to another drug trafficking organization that had been revealed or, for lack of a better term, busted. He just said there was a possible connection. That's why he went to get the videotapes. And that, Judge Tinder, is what Judge Simon found was the reason for for Agent Ritchie's comment. Judge Simon found that Agent Ritchie was only trying to explain why he went to the Porter County Jail and got audio tapes of telephone calls in the first place.
I guess what you're saying is that you wouldn't have otherwise monitored the phone calls with regard to this case.
All the phone calls at the Porter County Jail are monitored,
but
certainly
you don't always go in and listen to them.
Correct. It does take time, and in this case, in light of the fact that the defendants made our case essentially by sitting in the back of that squad car after their arrest and talking to each other about the drugs hidden in the bumpers and about the fact that they were, in some very blunt language, up a creek without a paddle, so to speak, that because we had that strong evidence, the jury could have quite reasonably wondered, why would they go track down these audio tapes of the defendants in jail, thinking that the defendants might have further incriminated themselves on phone calls? We were looking essentially for a needle in a haystack. We found it, of course, but there were it was the defendants' poor decisions in this case that ended up making the case for us, but no one would have guessed. I certainly would not have guessed that the defendants would go to the jail, call their co-conspirator, and I know that goes to the third issue here, but call someone named Nunco who didn't know their names, didn't know what names either of them had given. The defendants had to say, I'm Fernando Sanz, I'm Tomas Prieto. They had to tell Nunco who they were. Nunco said, the people at the ranch are wondering what happened. How did it go out? They start discussing the car with the hidden compartments in the bumpers. Nunco starts asking them, well, what happened? And the defendants say, as they're both on this phone call, handing the phone to each other, well, you know, the officer, it was straight, apparently referring to the bumper, but the officer had some experience in this. And Nunco says, and this is the key thing, no one is leaving you behind. He says that to them three times after finding out what happened during the conspiracy. This is definitely a phone call made to a co-conspirator for the purpose of discussing the conspiracy, the ongoing conspiracy, finding out the progress of the conspiracy, and again, making assurances to try to get the defendants not to reveal the existence or the scope of the conspiracy. This was certainly within the realm of co-conspirator hearsay and did properly come in. Seeing that my time has elapsed, I will ask you, Your Honor.
Not over quite yet, but had you made a Santiago proffer prior to offering that evidence?
We did, Judge Tinder. We offered a Santiago filing before the trial, and Judge Simon did consider that and did make an explicit finding that the existence of the conspiracy had been proven for purposes of Santiago.
I'm still having a little trouble with what the relevance was of the reference to this other investigation.
It was simply a matter of telling the story, Your Honor. It was simply a matter of explaining why Agent Ritchie went to the time and trouble to go to the Porter County Jail and pull phone calls for this case.
Do you have jurors asking you why you got more evidence? Isn't it usually the other way around? Why didn't you do the CSI type of thumbprint analysis or something like that?
I recognize, Judge Tinder, that that is often the impression that we get, that the jurors are hungry for more evidence. Certainly, defense counsel always hits us over the head if we don't have more evidence. But in this case, again, as Judge Simon referred to, this was, if it was anything other than just an explanation for why Agent Ritchie went to the Porter County Jail to listen to phone calls, then it was, as Judge Simon concluded, inextricably intertwined with the facts of this case in terms of telling the story and explaining to the jury why we had these phone calls, how we got them. Thank you. I ask that the court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Mr. Stewart, do you have rebuttal? How much time do we have? 2 minutes.
Let me respond to just a couple of arguments. One, in regard to there was no objection to the first testimony of silence. Perhaps there should have been, but I think the decision that I made on that, okay, let's let this thing go. Then very shortly afterward, we have another second reference, and that's when I objected, that's when I moved to a mistrial, and ultimately the district court, although not granting a mistrial, did agree with my position. Now,
and that's when you gave the instruction?
Correct. Okay. Now, Mr. Ratcliffe says, well, I wasn't really going after silence, I was going after expressions. Well, that's not what the testimony was. The testimony was these guys had blank looks on their faces, and certainly Mr. Ratcliffe's argument to the court at the bench conference on our objections was quite clear. Silence is relevant. Well, silence may be relevant, but it's unconstitutionally irrelevant. And I was baffled at the trial court level as to what this unrelated investigation that the government knew the defendants were involved in had to do with the phone calls. All they had to say was, did you review the phone calls? Now, it's interesting. This, not only was their testimony about this unrelated drug investigation, but the unrelated drug investigation revealed trafficking in meth and revealed trafficking between Lafayette and Chicago on I-65, and that's where the defendants were arrested. So that's even worse, suggesting to the jury, well, I had this other investigation where there was some drug running between Lafayette and Chicago, and the defendants in this case, although they're not related to that investigation, but by God, they were arrested on I-65. That was error, which requires reversal of this case. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, counsel. And a special thanks to counsel for the appellants for your accepting appointment in these cases and representing your clients in the highest commission bar. Thank you.